Blog Talk Radio.
Blog Talk Radio and the Cosmic Citizen. My name is Paula Thompson. I'm back this week with my dear friends, Andre Rodatis, Chuck Thurston, and Marvin Garin. Hi, you guys.
Hi, Paula.
Good morning.
Good morning, Paula.
Good morning. Well, this time last week, I was at Niagara Falls, and I have to say that I saw it for the first time. I've been there three times now, once after our conference in Montreal in 1993, once when I was 10 years old, and it was the most impressive thing I had ever seen in my young life. I was just blown away by Niagara Falls, to see that much water moving and to feel the power of it. It's just such an incredible thing. So I highly recommend it to anyone who's never been there. And we went to visit May Lee and Shunker, her boyfriend, in Cleveland, and they surprised us with a trip to Niagara Falls. So I'm sorry I wasn't here last week, but that was pretty hard to resist. And the falls, you know. I was just explaining before we went on that Shunker is here in the United States, and his sister Renji is in Canada, and she lives in Kitchener, where Andre, I think, grew up near there or there. And
my hometown.
Yeah, your hometown. And, of course, the border is still closed. So here they were, 200 yards apart. We met, and they waved at each other across the river. It was very touching. And they haven't seen each other for 3 years, so you know, I know how much they would have loved to embrace. Very close family, Shankar says. He grew up in southern India. He was actually born in Kenya. But very close family and lovely family, and they wanted to embrace, but all they could do was look at each other on FaceTime and wave across the river. It took a little while to pick them out, you know, because they were still quite small all the way over there on the other side. Beautiful place, though.
Yeah,
really,
it's not
really
close.
Beautiful place. No, it's not. I said 200 yards, but that's probably an underestimate.
Probably.
I don't know. I don't know how far exactly
they
it is across that river. No, they didn't, and they wished they had had them, but they didn't. And so, and you know, Andre, from being at the falls, that the spray is like getting pounded with rain at times. Yeah, because it, the power of the falls and that much water, and it's, you know, Lake Erie moving to Lake Ontario. And the whole time we were there, I kept thinking of Gordon Lightfoot's song, The Wreck of the Edmund Fitzgerald. Isn't that silly? But it's such a beautiful song, and it so captures those great lakes and the magnificence of them. So I couldn't help it. It's really spectacular to see that much water moving. And of course, I equate water, to me, water is a material representation of mother, because we're all born in a bag of waters. We're originally hatched in the briny deep, right, as a species on this planet, on any planet. And to me, water is a great... Not on every planet?
No.
Some of them aren't hatched in the briny deep, huh?
No, they're not. Not all of them.
Not all of them. Okay.
There's no briny deep on a non-breather world.
Okay. All right. And is there water? There's still water on those worlds?
Well, there could be.
That's
underneath,
interesting.
But that.
Yeah.
No, it's there are different ways to start. But you are on a different story. Go ahead.
No. And you know, that's interesting because I also equate breath with mother too, so that's mm-hmm. interesting. But yeah,
you
it's
know,
such
I
a
was,
good metaphor for spirit for me. Water.
I was. I was sitting just yesterday. Had a chance. I was out on a bike ride, and we're up in Spokane visiting family, and I was sitting. There's some lovely pathways all along the Spokane River in this city. Bike pathways, people walking, and it's full of nature. And there are some lovely spots to sit. And I was just sitting by the river and looking at this. Sort of a moderate-sized river. But there's something about the flow of water that is very, I agree with you, Paul, it's very spiritually evocative. Of course, the negative ions from the falls. But mm-hmm. just sitting there and seeing that mass of water, and in every millisecond, huge, the swirls, just the intricacy of it, there's something about it that's very, very representative of spirit in nature and the universe and the power and the scope of what God is doing in the natural creation. Mm-hmm. That is really, it was very spiritually uplifting to just look at the mass of the water that was moving every moment past me and the endless intricacy of the swirls. I think you're right. There's something about it that's very representative of the mother spirit, really, in the physical creation.
I really do too, Marvin. And I had a friend that called me years ago, and she used to live in Boulder, and she came to many of our study groups. She goes by Rabia. But we knew her as Illyria back then. And she moved to North Carolina. And she told me in a phone call, and it got me thinking. She said, you know, I like Boulder. Boulder and Colorado are lovely places, but they're very father energy-like to me. The mountains, she said, are very father-like to me. They're very strong and upholding. Whereas the South is much more mother-like. Being close to the water, to the ocean, is much more mother-like to me, very soft and malleable. And I thought, wow, that's so interesting. And it's interesting, it resonated with me because when I was a child, we would go on a picnic, my father, my grandmother, and me, and we'd go up into the mountains and we'd spread our blanket and my grandma would get a picnic ready and nothing flat. All my dad had to do was say, Mom, you want to go on a picnic? And she was like, she could have a picnic lunch ready in 20 minutes. And we'd go up there and spread our blanket and in some beautiful spot in the mountains and immediately get reverent, immediately start to contemplate God. So that's always been, the mountains have always been that for me, very, very conducive of reverence around the Father and God. And until she said that, I didn't think about the ocean being more mother-like, but I totally feel that now, the cradle of life, at least on this world. Maybe not on a non-breather planet, Andre. interesting.
Yeah.
So thanks, you guys, for holding down the fort. I appreciate it so much.
Speaking of our Mother Spirit, we sort of started into this amazing ministry that the angels engage in on our world, and just began to get into it in this paper on the angelic, the seraphic government on our world. And it's always kind of stimulating for me, it's almost on a feeling level, a sensing level, that our Mother Spirit is so present around us in the presence of our angelic sisters. And I feel them that way as my sisters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That they're performing a ministry in the environment, in the context within which we live, that is a very, very special kind of ministry for us. And it's dedicated to us and our well-being on this little, you know, this little planet in space. And so we're together with them in this endeavor. And it's just satisfying to read about it, you know.
Oh, without a doubt. I wanted to ask you guys a question, too, before we start. And because I love this paper. I've always loved this paper. And it was one of the glorious things of the revelation for me was the realization that there is a spiritual government here and spiritual beings resident on our world that watch over us, that care for our planetary condition, that work diligently to bring us forward slowly but surely, you know, help us evolve. And I just wondered what your impressions were when you first realized that there was a spiritual government on this planet. Any thoughts?
Well, I think it's consistent with the nature of the Mother Spirit in a way. I mean, I don't know if this directly addresses your question, but I came across a passage that I hadn't noticed before for some reason that reinforces this idea of her presence, you know, like you were talking about. And, you know, with the falls or the mountains or nature in general, you know, it's most beautiful and powerful. We get a sense, we feel a sense of presence in that.
Yeah.
It's a metaphor. It's a powerful metaphor, but there's also this just direct experience of the reality that's pretty profound. And it would make sense that, you know, we would have this seraphic administration in that they're children of the Infinite Spirit. Or the Mother Spirit through the Infinite Spirit through the Mother Spirit. But anyway, just listen to this. I don't know why I had never noticed this before, but it underscores what they bring up in the actual Mother Spirit paper. They're talking about the worlds. What kind of worlds are these? The transition culture worlds. And when they get to the number 6, this is in paper 4518, they're talking about the world of the Spirit. And they say that this sphere serves as the system rendezvous of the high personalities of the Infinite Spirit. I assume these are the worlds of the Ron Jerison. It says its 7 surrounding satellites are assigned to individual groups of these diverse orders. But on transition world number 6, there is no representation of the Spirit. Mm-hmm. Neither is such a presence to be observed on the system capitals. The divine minister of Salvington is everywhere in Nevadon. And I'm just like, okay, there it is.
She doesn't have to be
she's
already everywhere.
And now listen to this. This is about the Infinite Spirit. And they say that the Infinite Spirit is all the time, everywhere, present.
Right.
So that characteristic of her everywhere presence is just in the nature of the source, of course, which is the infinite spirit. So it's, I don't know, it's kind of cool to think about how that's connected. When we talk about a mother, you know, that's the infinite spirit. You know, sometimes you use male pronouns, but they also refer to the infinite spirit as the infinite mother. So, like our mother spirit here in the local universe. So that everywhere presence, I don't know. To me, that it's like, I don't know how that connects exactly with these master seraphim who are part of the seraphic planetary government. But, you know, when you think about spirit being the source of mind, just their inherent capacity for coordination and, you know, communication, coordination, all those characteristics, with, you know, it makes perfect sense that they would be in that role.
Yes.
Well, I think
the nature of master seraphim, who are like the equivalent of finalities for seraphim. They're like seraphim finalities.
Good point.
Yeah. So they have a master.
Yeah, I think.
That's why they call them master seraphim.
I
think of when I think of the infinite spirit and the mother spirit, and they refer to the supreme as she as well as mother, or mother God the supreme. So I think of all of those on the feminine side of the aisle, almost in a sense, in terms of deity manifestation and how they manifest. And two things come to mind. And what you were saying, Chuck, really sparked some of those recollections for me. Two things come to mind as regards the infinite spirit and the mother spirit. One is that our mother spirit and the infinite spirit, when I was sitting by the river, when you were by the falls there, Paula, everything that we are part of, the air, the sunlight, the mist, the water, everything in the environment, materially, physically, that is spiritually evocative, and everything mindily, that with which the minds with which we are thinking, the very thoughts we have are happening in the medium of her mindal energies, and in the medium of her physical environment. She is the flowing energies of matter, mind, and Marantia and spirit. The conduits through which everything happens. So it's like the warp and woof, you know, thought that we've had. We are, it's the substance, the ground of our being is how I think of her as goddess feminine. And the other thing that for me is very connected to the seraphic government here is that the conjoined actor is exactly that. The spirit is the action representative of the plan of the Father and the Son. So the spirit's mission is to execute, to make the intention and the plan and the conception that the Father and the Son originated actionable, to make it actually happen. So when I think of the planetary government, what I'm thinking is it's our mother spirit who's working closely with the Father and the Son to actually execute on the plans for our world. And that's why the seraphic corps are in her column, in a sense, because it's execution of the plan. And the other thing that was really interesting, I was just looking at one of the sections we were reading a week or two, last week, is, you know, you have these 4 and 20 counselors. Human beings are very intimate partners with the angels, in ways we don't recognize, and a little higher up in the mansion worlds in immediate ways. We're very open and overt partners and co-workers with the angels. So it's just, it's really an intriguing part of the enterprise.
Such an amazing to contemplate these things. And I, you know, I love that section, the first section from 3 and the resident governor general, because they tell us that they can't tell us who, that the governor general just changed over, Which makes perfect sense, right? When you go back, when you count back every 100 years from the time Michael established the Council of 420, they've been rotating, you know, in every 100 years and on this planet, and that it just changed. Well, that would have been exactly right in the early 1930s. And but they can't tell us who that is because we're so prone to venerate. And I remember one time I was reading that, and I thought to myself, well, okay, so you can't tell us who it is. Let me see if I can vibe it. And I closed my eyes, and I was just meditating on who might be prevalent here. And then suddenly my mind flooded with characteristics of the last, century, the rise of women and the rise of equality and the reemergence of natural medicines and women's suffrage. And just all of these things came flooding to my mind. And then the visions, I also thought of the visions at Medjugorje and Fatima. And I thought, wow, maybe it's Eve. Maybe our mother is here. And if she is, then, yeah, it would make sense that she's working to reestablish male-female balance and equality. And it just really thrilled me to think of that. And I contemplate her a lot simply because, being a mother, I can't help but empathize with how much sorrow she must have with the centuries of suffering that have gone on here on this world, and how she probably holds herself responsible for much of it. And maybe, you know, at that level of spirituality, you don't do that kind of thing. I don't know. You know, but I can't help but empathize with the sorrow she must have carried all these centuries.
Oh, yeah, it's unimaginable.
Yeah. When she sees how we suffer with disease, you know, with so
yeah.
many things.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I'm sure she's not without feeling even now.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's sort of an interesting thread of our conversation here, an interesting sort of side portion. But I think it's very relevant. As, you know, I think about all of us have things that have happened in our lives that we're not happy about. We wish we could have done them differently, charted a different course. And we live with the results, and they make us a little sad. And most of what we're doing in life is good and whole and moving forward. But there are things, you know, in every life, you know, what is it? There's no life that goes on without some rain falling in it. But you think of the scale of how Eve and Adam must feel about the history that they were part of, and just the pathos of it, you know, the depth of it, and the breadth of the impacts, and I think it's worth mentioning that I know all three of us, all four of us feel this. This the love we have for them, and the sense of understanding of their plight and how they struggled, and the honoring of Eve and Adam, you know, that they're here, they repented and understood and have done everything they could to make up for and compensate for the errors, their errors. Yeah, and they're here serving and uplifting us, and just to feel a deep sense of thanks and appreciation for them and their duty and their responsibility in very, very difficult circumstances. Yeah.
Well, in light of all of this, is there any way that we can fail to achieve our goal of light and life?
Well,
I really don't think
that's an interesting question. No,
we can't fail.
We can't fail.
No.
It's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when, right, Andre, wouldn't you say?
Oh, absolutely.
We may have to go through a lot of hell.
It's not a foregone conclusion. They're not going to hand it to us on a platter.
Right.
But if we are willing simply you know, as individuals and as a collective to move forward, you know, to do our best to do our best to be in the presence of God and to serve our fellows, the world will get better.
Yeah.
And that's all that it takes. But the idea of, you know, most people don't even know what they're wishing for when they're wishing for light in life. Most people, if they had light in life handed to them on a platter, wouldn't know what to do with it. It requires it requires integration. It requires cultural readiness, and not to mention psychological readiness and spiritual readiness for that kind of thing, because there are responsibilities. You know, one of the things that's spoken of in the Arantia book is the slow evolution of a culture from the negative to the positive era of law. And what they mean by that is one which is doing less prohibition and more prescription, okay, of what ought to be done. And
like a good parent.
And that's a very interesting way. And there will be laws surrounding that. And there will be fewer. They also say there will be fewer laws as they become somewhat internalized. But they still have to be internalized.
Right.
Well, and there's several epics that we have to pass through before we reach light and life, of course. Maybe
yeah.
We should just be working on the next one. Maybe just be working on the next one.
Well, we should just be working on this one. Let's try
well,
to get
they,
out,
yeah,
out of
right.
the post
We're
looking
forward to damage.
Forward
you
know,
to damage,
beyond,
right?
Of course.
Yeah, we're in the post-bestowal sun age, but we're not of it. We are.
Right.
We are really more in the post.
Cross.
Yeah, really more post-planetary prince, post-Adamic in
yeah.
various aspects.
More than a full dispensation behind, they tell us. And
yeah.
Which, when you look at that great paper, the Seven Planetary Mortal Epics, you really see it. But it does give us a roadmap. And I think, I'm not sure if it says it in that paper or elsewhere, but that the quality of thinking is our next great... achievement,
mm-hmm.
our next great goal.
And that makes sense from the standpoint of when we look at what the magisterial mission is all about. When the magisterial son comes for the first missions, not, you know, before the bestowal, you know, and there won't be a magisterial bestowal on this planet because the creator son fulfilled that and did it out
right.
of order.
Right.
So we will probably have a magisterial mission and maybe many missions before the teacher son age, but we've already had the bestowal, and that is, you know, causing its own kinds of issues for them. But, you know, without digressing, what happens in the magisterial mission is that, first of all, the world is unified already. I mean, the world is unified under one world government, okay? It's not perfect. There's nothing perfect happening. But there is at least the recognition that the world needs to function as a whole. There's also the worldwide vogue of the desire to pursue philosophy, and this doesn't mean abstract philosophy. It means philosophy as Rodin was talking about it,
mm-hmm.
about an art of living that is both logical and practical and meaningful.
And moral.
And moral and imbued with spirituality,
mm-hmm.
you know, that tries to unify the inner and the outer life. Well, that we're some ways away from that. For a worldwide vogue. There are people on the vanguard but we'd be lucky to say that it's 1% of 1%. Maybe 1/10 mm-hmm. of 1% are really mm-hmm. thinking that way.
Hmm. Well, you're saying those are prerequisites for the magisterial. I just wanted to clarify that.
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. You know, that's what I was thinking in response. I think you were asking, Paul, you know, is it a guarantee that we're going to hit, we're going to make light and light? I think it is. I think it's inevitable. And I think, you know, as they indicate in a few different places, there's such an array of personalities and resources all the way from Michael's second coming to Melchizedek to the Adam and Eve and to the, you know, the remnants of the planetary prince. You know, all of these things one of the things that's so strange about our situation is we are strung along this incredibly long historical line of much of our culture still on this world is back in primitive times, a fair mm-hmm. bit of it, you know, mm-hmm. and one of the things though, and yet here we have this Urantia revelation, which is revealing stuff to us all the way up to paradise and on beyond into the age of the ultimate. You know, teasing us with images of what comes after the age of the supreme, which is incredibly sophisticated stuff, you know. And so there's a small group of us who are messing around with that kind of information. And that's all happening on one world, you know. And what occurred to me in response to your question, Paula, was I thought of the statement, I've thought of it several times in the last couple of years, about the planetary prince, that their primary mission over a 500,000-year period, half a million years, right, is their sort of stretch of their mission, or much of it, is to help humanity move from the herder, from the hunter stage to the herder, and then eventually the farmer stage.
Hmm.
An unimaginably long period of time to make that transition. And what was occurring to me was here we are in the present time, our time right now, and we have this remarkably complex revelation. It gives us so much information. And on some level, the large majority of humanity is back at a place where their primary struggle is A, to recognize that there is a God, and B, primarily to figure out how to get into intimate companionship with that God. Mm. You know, mm. that this revelation is saying you can live your life intimately in sharing with God. And most people don't have that conception. They think of deity as far away and abstract and, you know, powerful. They don't see it as intimately connected in their personal lives. And so in a strange way, I think every revelation has this, and Adam and Eve was thinking, Adam tried to establish representative government, the beginnings of representative government, and it was such a mess because of the Lucifer rebellion that he couldn't do it, and he had to give up and establish titular leaders, you know, local leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So we're in this situation as well, where we have these grand visions and possibilities and aspirations, and we're here in the pragmatic, limited sphere of this rebellion-torn world, and we have to figure out what are the needs right around us and how do we respond to them, given what we have with this revelation. And it's a stretch, you know? It's a stretch to figure out how to do something worthwhile and achievable in our world with what we're working with, and yet that's what we're called to. You know,
mm-hmm.
right?
If
I could
in that way.
Add to that, it just occurred to me while you were saying all that you know, the way this planet, in a sense, is spread over so many dispensations, you know, from as you were describing. I mean, if you look at the planet as a whole, it like goes all the way back to almost the most primitive stages to these, you know, emerging higher understandings and everything in between, both culturally
all
and
coexisting.
Individually. How that provides opportunities for service, you know, that's a feature, that's a feature of our situation, you could almost
that's
say,
true.
Because if you're on a normal world where everybody's kind of moving along together, right,
mm-hmm.
and everybody's pretty much, you know, around the same stage and moving on together, I'd say there wouldn't be opportunities for service under those circumstances as well.
Not as many,
not
anyway,
as,
or
as
varied.
Not in such a dramatic scenario that, you know, like we have. So maybe that's a, I don't know if that's a plus side, but it certainly is fact, I think, that our situation, as peculiar as it is, with having a bestowal son, having been here already, while the planet was in such a mess, you know, that creates this divinity tension. You know, how the Grand Book talks about divinity tension sometimes. Something like that, where there's a spiritual tension on the planet, if not an outright war going on.
Yes.
Over the nature of God. And the realization and discovery of that by those who are informed by the, you know, the bestowal of Jesus and however else they access that. And those who are, like, actively opposing it. I mean, literally. So
literally,
what a
peculiar,
challenging world this is.
And
but
for those of us
it
who...
also can bring out, it can bring out the best in us, I guess, is what I'm trying to say there.
It can,
if
but
really
but it can also overwhelm us, I think.
Well, it can,
yeah.
But that's part of the challenge.
Yeah, that's true.
Serving on this planet is not being overwhelmed.
Yeah. That, or
not
or
say
fighting
that
against
that.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah,
yeah,
I mean,
yeah,
because
challenge.
It overwhelmed Adam and Eve, and they were perfect.
Right.
You know,
we're
by comparison to us.
But still,
yeah, the challenge, interestingly enough, the challenge is the same that was theirs, is our challenge as well, because as they were representative of epical revelation on an evolutionary world. And there's the collision, the meeting point of revelation and evolutionary culture. And we're faced with a different set of challenges, but it's in the same realm. We have revelation, but we're challenged to respond to the needs in service to the Supreme. We're in response to the need of the culture within which we exist. Jesus faced the same set of challenges, and he succeeded in some ways, and he didn't in others. And what he didn't remains to be done. You know, on some level. Melchizedek too. On some level, what Jesus tried to accomplish was this sense of deep personal relationship with God, and indeed a family paradigm as to what we're all part of. Mm-hmm. And he had to compromise with the kingdom terminology. And so he accomplished some things, and he said there are some things that are yet out ahead that people of another age will accomplish. And here we are in another age with another revelation, and working to grapple with these endeavors,
right.
You know. And
the same
so
problem.
The saga goes on, you know, of the meeting of revelation with evolutionary reality, and doing our best to serve in our generation, mm-hmm. as the we move through our short lives and on to the mansion world. So it's really
one of the intriguing things to me also about Jesus and the situation he was in on this world is that he was also teaching for the entire local universe.
Yeah.
His work and his life, even not just for this world. So that implies that it was, he was either being watched on, live TV all throughout Lebanon or something like that.
Original reality.
Right. And his life will be replayed and re-examined, re-experienced over and over throughout Lebanon, going into eternity, really, including by us. I mean, just wait till we get to the mansion world to get a full, even fuller picture. But to think of the Urantia book kind of in the same terms, it's kind of intriguing in the sense that maybe this planet's being watched to see how it works out.
I think it is being watched for sure.
Revelation in book form. I don't know if that's, has that even been done? I don't think the book really says if that's ever been done before. But it certainly
I think
no
it's
idea.
Pretty unprecedented. I think
they normally
send a being.
It has to do with being a rebellion planet because that wouldn't be necessary otherwise.
Right.
But still, the idea that how this plays out and what we make of it, how it affects our lives, is definitely going to be, I'm sure, is really observed carefully. Not self-conscious about it. Still, think of our engagement with the Iran's book as, in some ways, as being similar to Jesus in that he was speaking to the all of Nebuchadnezzar. We're not intending to do that, but that may in fact kind of be the case.
Well, there's a reason they call it the sentimental shrine of all Nebuchadnezzar.
Right.
And we wouldn't be the sentimental
thing.
Shrine otherwise.
Did you hear about the book thing on your end?
Yeah.
Everybody goes,
yeah,
whoa.
I think we're one of the news stories that the universe probably likes to follow.
Right.
You know?
Does the Urantia book still stand?
How are those Urantians doing down there anyway?
Yeah.
You know? Right. Speaking of
what do they make of that book we dropped in their lap?
Right. Mo likes to say they sent us a book because they couldn't get any volunteers after they saw what we did to Jesus.
No,
which is funny and sad at the same
that.
Time. I mean, yeah.
Yeah,
I know.
No, I think it's, yeah. We may not get another incarnated son until the planet,
right.
At least relatively.
Not for a while, anyway.
Recognize and protect such a person. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, anyway. That's a great segue to our Most High Observer, don't you think, you guys? And we can
I'll
just
say,
jump
look
in.
At that. That was pretty slick, Paula.
Did it blow your hair back?
Yeah.
No, I know it didn't because we're more than 40 minutes into the show. So.
We're 40 minutes.
Yeah.
So, Paula,
we'll call it a transition.
Do you want to read it, Paula?
Yes, I would like to read it. That'd be great. Thank you. So this is what?
Back over part section 3 or just move on to 4?
Well, I thought we kind of did, but if there's something else you wanted to point out, that's fine too.
Either way,
we can go back to it. We can come
back.
You
know, what we could do is someone could just read that straight through, and then we could pick right back up because there's some continuity there between 3 and 4,
yes.
And then
okay.
Read section 4. So we sort of review both of them.
Yeah, because 4 isn't very long. Yeah,
you weren't here last week, so.
Okay, so I'll read 4. The Most High Observer. The sovereignty of Urantia is further complicated by the one-time arbitrary seizure of planetary authority by the government of Norlaishadek shortly after the planetary rebellion. There is still resident on Urantia a Verandadek's son, an observer for the Most Highs of Edentia, and, in the absence of direct action by Michael, trustee of planetary sovereignty. The present Most High Observer and sometime regent, is the 23rd thus to serve on Urantia. There are certain groups of planetary problems which are still under the control of the Most Highs of Edentia, jurisdiction over them having been seized at the time of the Lucifer Rebellion. Authority in these matters is exercised by Verandadek's son, the Norlaishadek Observer, who maintains very close advisory relations with the planetary supervisors. The race commissioners are very active on Urantia, and their various group chiefs are informally attached to the resident Verandadek Observer, who acts as their advisory director. In a crisis, the actual and sovereign head of the government, excepting in certain purely spiritual matters, would be this Verandadek's son of Edentia, now on observation duty. In these exclusively spiritual problems, and in certain purely personal matters, the supreme authority seems to be vested in the commanding archangel attached to the divisional headquarters of that order, which was recently established on Urantia. A Most High Observer is empowered, at his discretion, to seize the planetary government in times of grave planetary crisis. And it is of record that this has happened 33 times in the history of Urantia. Keep in mind, this was written in the 1930s. At such times, the Most High Observer functions as the Most High Regent, exercising unquestioned authority over all ministers and administrators resident on the planet, excepting only the divisional organization of the archangels. Verandadec regencies are not peculiar to rebellion-isolated planets, for the Most Highs may intervene at any time in the affairs of the inhabited worlds, interposing the superior wisdom of the constellation rulers in the affairs of the kingdoms of men. Boy, there's just such a lot of intrigue there.
Well, the obvious question, I don't know if it was obvious to any of you, but in that next to last paragraph, what are the 33 times in history that happened? Yeah.
Right.
As of 1933 or 34, whatever year this was written, what were they as of then? Because I think we can safely assume that there may have been a couple more, at least, to happen since then, don't you think, given the nature of the 20th century?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
There's the one period in the 1980s, you know, that they look back. I haven't heard that much written about it, but, you know, where we came fairly close to a nuclear confrontation, that's a pretty obvious one. But you know, this seizure goes back to the times of shortly after the rebellion was inaugurated. So the 33 times refers to a long period of time.
Right. How long would that be, Andre? How many thousands of years?
That's 200,000. That's 200,000 years from the first time of the function of the Verandadec Observer. So we don't know what would constitute all these crises in that entire period. If they were spread out evenly, which I doubt that they were, it doesn't seem like an emergency happens according to a clock. You would wonder about it. The question that is maybe putting a finer point on the question that Marvin is asking is like, well, what was the 33rd and the 32nd? What did they look like? Because if we could know that, we could know something about what the other ones might look like.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly they were dealing with all kinds of things occurring right at the end of, the planetary prince regime, as that was, you know, falling apart and going into rebellion and all of that. We can only imagine what were the issues that they had to deal with on a primitive world that would prevent it from getting even worse. it was already a primitive world. What were they dealing with?
Maybe it wouldn't be anything earth-shattering as we know it. And I can't help but think about this cross-reference here from Paper 62, Section 3, Paragraph 9. It says, you can hardly realize by what narrow margins your pre-human ancestors missed extinction from time to time.
Yeah.
Had the ancestral frog of all humanity jumped 2 inches less on a certain occasion, the whole course of evolution would have been markedly changed. And then they go on to say the immediate lemur-like mother of the dawn mammal species escaped death no less than 5 times by a hairbreadth margins before she gave birth to the father of the new and higher mammalian order. But the closest call of all was when lightning struck the tree in which the prospective mother of the primate twins was sleeping. I won't keep going, but, you know, it might be very simple things like that. Just, you know, tickling that frog a little bit to get it to jump a couple of inches further. You know, it might be that simple.
Well, you always have to wonder. I mean, I always wonder at least. I mean, what is the range of permission? How bad is something allowed to be? still and be allowed to happen. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
like,
right.
Where do they draw the line, and for what reason? And you know, civilization itself is being put in jeopardy. I think that would be a line that they wouldn't want to have crossed. But obviously, a lot of things are allowed to happen that are pretty devastating. So,
well, even civilization is in jeopardy many times. You know, in terms of its outward form. You know, one of the things they point out is that civilization isn't carried, you know, by, for instance, the governmental form necessarily or anything. When Rome fell, there were still plenty of people that were carrying the culture that carried on. It's really in the families that cultures are carried on when you
that's
really look
point.
At it. And it's a very a very significant aspect there. But you do bring up some interesting points, Chuck, in terms of what would they allow to happen. Well, they allowed Nagasaki and Hiroshima to happen.
Yeah,
they did indeed. Yeah.
Okay.
That's probably the strongest example.
They've allowed communism to take two of the largest nations on Earth. Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, the territorially largest and the third largest nations on Earth are dominated by a retrogressive form of government, or were, and still haven't come very far. And that they allow.
Well, or they weren't able to stop it. Yeah.
Well, they're not in the business of stopping necessarily.
Well,
they're,
I don't mean them personally, but the human efforts that they sponsor.
Right. What they're concerned about, partly.
Yeah.
Oh, go ahead. Make your point.
Well, no, I just where that line of allowing comes in. I mean, some of these things take a long time to work out. But yeah, communism was a huge attack on theistic civilization on this world, and it's highly organized. And you know, maybe they tried to stop it, and were they able to? I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's also a possibility. Not them, you know. It's kind of a mystery when they say the Most High's rule in the kingdoms of men. I mean, they obviously don't do it directly. A Verondadex son doesn't just like step into the middle of everything and start slapping everybody around. You know, it has to be done through humans.
Well, I find it very interesting that they bring up that the race commissioners are very active.
Yeah.
And of course,
I found that interesting, too.
The race commissioners are made up of, you know, progressed spirit fusers. Okay? They're Nebadon, you know, one-time mortal ascenders who have progressed to the point where then they are denominated race commissioners. If I'm not mistaken, I believe they are, you know, graduates at that point of the Salvington schools, though they wouldn't say it necessarily exactly
that
way.
Do you?
Go ahead. Please.
Yeah, I'll just read a couple of paragraphs.
Because I think it's very, I think it's significant to try to understand, you know, why is that put forward here as the thing to note in this short a section.
Well, these three paragraphs, I think, will explain that. And
go ahead.
This is paper 37, section 5, starting maybe paragraph 4, about high commissioners.
Mm-hmm.
And they say that after attaining the Nebadon core of perfection, spirit-fused ascenders, like you're saying, may accept assignment as universe aides. This being one of the avenues of continuing experiential growth, which is open to them. Thus, could they become candidates for commissions to the high service of interpreting the viewpoints of the evolving creatures of the material worlds to the celestial authorities of the local universe. The high commissioners begin their service on the planets as race commissioners.
Mm.
In this capacity, they interpret the viewpoints and portray the needs of the various human races. They're supremely devoted to the welfare of the mortal races whose spokesmen they are, ever seeking to obtain for them mercy, justice, and fair treatment in all relationships with other peoples. Mm-hmm. Race commissioners function in an endless series of planetary crises and serve as the articulate expression of whole groups of struggling mortals.
Wow.
After long experience in problem-solving on the inhabited worlds, these race commissioners are advanced to the higher levels of function, eventually attaining the status of high commissioners of and in the local universes. Anyway, and then it goes on to other stuff. But
yeah, that's great elaboration.
Isn't that interesting?
Thank you, Chuck.
Yeah.
So that explains why they would be associated with the Diranidex receivers.
Yeah, and it tells me that this race issue, these racial problems that we face and that we have faced forever, is one of the greatest problems faced on any planet. You know, to overcome that is one of the biggest challenges. Those natural animosities and misunderstandings and prejudices and whatever you want to call them, they're the hardest to overcome. And so it takes a great deal of effort.
Well, made worse by rebellion.
Yes, by far.
Since we don't have the endowment bestowal to kind of inspire all the races to their past.
Right.
So that's an easy thing for Caligastri to stir up, too.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Because it's a natural propensity to be suspicious. Always blame the other.
Yeah.
It's all them. Uh-huh. It's their fault. You know, it's
right.
a whole other,
them, yeah.
whoever they are, you know.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you take a look at what's going on. I'm thinking particularly in North America here now in relation to race relations. And it's obviously... the last 100 years and the coming, you know, centuries are critical times of transition for the relations among the races, you know. So we're in the middle of it, as we are in the middle of the emergence of women as well. It seems to be a critical age in a number of ways, I do think that they describe Melchizedek's mission as an emergency revelation. I actually do think the Urantia revelation is also an emergency revelation. It's out of the normal order. It's out of the normal mechanism of how revelation happens, and it's an experiment designed to deal with an exigency that is our current situation, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Several centuries, and I in relation still back to your question of reaching eventually light and light, I think we're at a critical juncture, and I was going to, so I picked out some paragraphs in paper 195 that go to this question of, you know, are we in a state of crisis? And I think in some sense we are. They say that Melchizedek came because the light of monotheism, the light of spiritual truth, was flickering and almost going out, which was a dangerous situation for the trajectory of our spiritual civilization. And then in paper 195, they make, I'll just pick a few paragraphs. The first is 195.8.3. At the time of this revelation, meaning back in the 30s, and I think it's still very much true, if not more true, the prevailing intellectual and philosophical climate of both European and American life is decidedly secular, humanistic. For 300 years, so they've been looking at this as a trajectory over three centuries, right? For 300 years.
Which they can do. Which
they
can and do.
Yeah, and they can cross-compare to millions of other worlds and the angelic records of millions of other worlds. They know what's kind of going on. They can extrapolate. For 300 years, Western thinking has been progressively secularized. Religion has become more and more a nominal influence, largely a ritualistic exercise. The majority of professed Christians of Western civilization are unwittingly actual secularists. And then further on in the next section, yeah, paganized and socialized Christianity stands in need of new contact with the uncompromised teachings of Jesus. It languishes for a new vision of the Master's life on earth. A new and fuller revelation of the religion of Jesus is destined to conquer an empire of materialistic secularism. So there's the solution they're hoping for, right? To overthrow a world sway of mechanistic naturalism. Well, I think that's the crisis we're in the middle of. And they end that paragraph by saying Urantia is now quivering on the very brink of one of its most amazing and enthralling epics of social readjustment, moral quickening, and spiritual enlightenment. So we're at this critical juncture. I think it's one of these crises. And then they go on, you know, religion does need new, you're familiar with these, 195.94. Religion does need new leaders, spiritual men and women, et cetera, dare to depend upon Jesus and his incomparable mission.
Teachings.
And then they say the spiritual renaissance must await the coming of these new teachers of Jesus' religion who will be exclusively devoted to the spiritual regeneration of men. So, I mean, obviously, that's smack dab in the middle of what we're struggling, we're called to some extent. As purveyors of this new revelation, we have this information about Jesus and his life and what he was really trying to convey. And then they make this statement, which is intriguing in relation to the secularism, right? They say, and then will these spirit-born souls quickly supply, meaning the people who are ministered to by these spiritual teachers, right? And then will these spirit-born souls quickly supply the leadership and inspiration, was it for the social, moral, economic and political reorganization of the world. So, you know, the priority is the spreading of a spiritual restatement of Jesus' teachings that will really inspire people, connect them, and that out of that larger spirit-born group can come the leadership in all the other realms to refashion the world. But we're at a critical juncture, I think, is what they're saying. And that's why we have this revelation, and you know, we're slowly getting started with it, but it's very related to these core of the angels who are working in all of these realms.
And there's so many warnings in the book and so many admonitions and really stringent, you know, things that they say along those lines, Marvin. I mean, I think that paper has the most potent ones, but here's another example. This is from paper 99, section 5, paragraph 9. It says, primitive man made little effort to put his religious convictions into words. His religion was danced out rather than thought out. Modern men have thought out many creeds and created many tests of religious faith. Future religionists must live out their religion, dedicate themselves to the wholehearted service of the brotherhood of man. It is high time that man had a religious experience so personal and so sublime that it could only be realized and expressed, that it could be realized and expressed only by feelings that lie too deep for words. You know, that is not what they just described is not secularism. You know, that's a full-on embrace of the reality of the Creator and the marvelous gifts that we've all been given and our responsibility to the world and the brotherhood of man.
Well, they also talk about the benign virus of love, too. That's a good
one.
But there's a the factor, just, I don't know quite how to put it, but just sort of being appealing, you know, that comes from being spirit-led. You know, the more that grows within us, the more we're able to kind of let go of conflict and just go with a continual presentation of something positive. You know, it's like the nature of life on this world. We're always getting sucked into conflicts, like, all the time. You know, division.
Yeah, we allow our
whatever.
To get
but to be able to articulate a vision that can unify all the good sentiments of people. Because well-intentioned people often end up in conflict. You know,
true.
So to be able to resolve that with a higher perspective, it just feels natural and right, I think.
So, yeah. You know, that's it. That's it, that there's a direct connection between this spiritual mission of reaching people with a representation of the vision of what Jesus was showing us was available to us. There's a connection between that and the reformulation of all of the societal structures and the making of a new world towards the ages of light and life. There's a connection between those two. And a couple of last paragraphs in that section, paper 195, no social, and again, this speaks to me to the question that you were asking, which is, are we in the midst of a crisis time? Is this an emergency mm-hmm. revelation? What mm-hmm. purpose has it been given us to, and what should we be busy with, you know, in a sense?
And it also speaks to what our planetary supervisors are probably working on and doing right
yes.
now, even as we speak.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So I'm in here are two more paragraphs. It's 195, 10, 7, and 6. No social system or political regime which denies the reality of God can contribute in any constructive and lasting manner to the advancement of human civilization. You know, your allusion earlier, Andre, to China and Russia and these mm-hmm. atheistic philosophies of government, you know, which deny God. And they're saying that's disastrous. That's a real crisis in planetary culture. But Christianity, as it is subdivided and secularized today, there's that word, secularization, mm-hmm. presents the greatest single obstacle to its further advancement, especially is this true concerning the Orient. And then, sorry, just the last one, the call to the adventure of building a new and transformed human society. So that's the adventure, and what we're sort of facing. By means of the spiritual rebirth of Jesus' brotherhood of the kingdom, should thrill all who believe in him as men have not been stirred since the days when they walked about on earth as his companions in the flesh. So there is this connection between the spiritual rebirth, the spiritual renaissance, and the refashioning of the societal structures at this point in global civilization. And I think it's a crisis, and I think the Urantia Book was given to us to speak to that crisis eventually in the next mm-hmm. few hundred years. Yeah.
Yeah, because we have to get to know it well enough to be able to assimilate it to the point where we can actually teach it. And Perry on the board just asked a wonderful question. She said, so many are spiritual, not traditionally religious. What are they feeling? I contemplate that a lot, actually. What are they feeling? What must it be like to be, alive right now in this world with all of its challenges and the fast pace of life as it is right now in this world? So much to do, so much to comprehend, so much to hear and assimilate. What must it be like? What are they feeling when they are spiritual, but they have, you know, they're not really traditionally religious? And coupled with that, I would add, they're spiritual, but they don't necessarily know what that means.
That's exactly what I was going to say, Paula. I think the state of many, many people in the spiritual, not religious realm is that they are hungry, many times desperately hungry, searching, seeking, and they don't really have a clear sense of access to good spiritual food that
right.
is really spiritually sustaining. And so I think the evolutionary task that we have with this, you know, amazing gift of revelation is to figure out how to approach them and share with them the truth of the gospel reconfigured in a way that they can assimilate and begin to put into use in their lives that is meaningful to feed that hunger. And it's not an easy thing to do. I think it's a complex task. But I think that's the beginnings of addressing the spiritual crisis of our age, of a secular civilization that has sort of lost its way spiritually and is trying to find its way back to real high qualities of truth. And Jesus' gospel is it, restated, you know, represented for the modern culture. So I think that's our challenge.
Yeah, it has to transform us in the process.
Yeah.
You know, we have to be, you know, it's the thing about what does extent, but you have to go out with your truth as a measure of how, you know, people are not coming to you. So just as a general principle, you know, that Jesus pointed out, encouraging the apostles to live the truth they're teaching, not just teach it, but to live it and be transformed by it, actually be an actual demonstration of the reality of it, which, of course, Jesus was in spades. So to kind of you know, see him that way and try to, you know, it's more about, well, I don't know, it's all part of it, but.
Well, that's absolutely true. I mean, that's the only way it can be effective. You're so on on target, Chuck. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
it's Perry also
what
just
was the
said
end of
the spirituality.
That yeah.
Which one, Chuck? Which quote?
Oh, that we should be inspired or thrilled like none other, or something like that.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Like never before, I think.
Yeah, that's pretty. Inspiring and challenging. That comment.
Perry made a comment on the board.
It's just, I'll just tuck it in here because you alluded to it, and then Paula, please, share Perry's comment. It's 195:10-6, and the language is very interesting. It's a very short paragraph. It says the call to the adventure of building a new and transformed human society. That's a big task, building a new and transformed human society.
That's quite an adventure.
Why not?
Yeah. And then they say,
what else do we have to do?
Yeah, right.
And then they say, by means of the spiritual rebirth of Jesus, brotherhood of the kingdom, should thrill all who believe in him. So there's a sequence here, you know. First comes the spiritual rebirth of Jesus' really true vision and the sharing of that. And on that foundation, humanity can begin to build a new and transformed human society. So we're talking about something that's going to be taking many, many hundreds, if not thousands of years, many thousands of years. But what it begins with, and in a sense what we're tasked with, is this representation of what Jesus was actually sharing to Christianity, to all the religions, and to the spiritual, not religious. That's a huge endeavor. And yet we're starting to be busy with it, you know. We're starting to do that as a movement with this revelation. It's a beginning. You know?
Yeah, right.
And
yeah, well, what Perry said is...
Yeah.
Okay, let me just get this in and then you keep going. She said the spirituality without the knowledge of God tends towards superstition, and I agree with that, and it's going to be interesting to, you know, obviously what you just laid out, Marvin, is fraught with a lot of difficulties and a lot of challenges to overcome. And I can't help but think of how, you know, eloquent people mount, you know, eloquent defenses against a belief in God. That'd be the first and foremost challenge we have. And, you know, the scientific tendency to just, you know, dismiss that, but actually, if you look at some of the best scientists the world has ever known, they did believe in God. In fact, their science led them to God, which is, I think, will inevitably happen with science. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah, that's definitely true. And then in between, it's like this whole New Age spirituality,
right?
Which
true.
Is trying to be spiritual without God for the most part. I mean, there's some recognition of God.
What they call a metaphysics, you know, a metaphysics, which is, you know, it's poor food for spiritual hunger, you know, but people are desperate.
But it might be a transition. It might be a stepping stone.
I think it is. At least they're looking.
Yeah.
And I've spent a lot of time hanging out with them, telling them about the Urantia book, and I can tell you that they are very interested in Jesus.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they have a great reverence for Jesus, and that's a good thing. You know, and I think, and our dear friend Diane is on the board today too. Hi, Diane. So good to see you guys and Gary, and all of our dear friends, Robert and everybody. You know, she would tell us that people all over the world are discovering that they want to know more about Jesus. And there's tremendous evidence of that, even in Muslim countries. There's a great hunger for Jesus. So, you know, and
there would be
with
Asians. Yeah.
Yeah. All we have to do,
well,
our
I
job
think,
is to hold
think,
him up.
I think the phrasing is Jesus and his incomparable teachings, right? What they're hungry
right.
for is not just saying believe in Jesus. And, you know, what they're saying is share and live what Jesus taught and said, and basically convey the realization that you too can have what Jesus was speaking about and how he lived. That's he
right.
came to give us the gift of his life as the model for the kinds of lives that we can live. And
right.
here's what he taught. You know, he taught about this intimate parent-child relationship with God that anyone can have, and that God's presence is deep inside each one of us, and we can access it in worship and pray and love each other and serve in this intimate relationship with the Father. That's what he taught.
Right.
So, you know, the challenge is to live as he lived, to minister as he lived, as he ministered, but to teach what he actually taught us as the way forward. You know,
yeah.
And as regards the virulent atheists who are preaching atheism, I think as Jesus did, we don't have to take them on. We don't have to argue with them. Let them have their, you know, podiums. What we need to do is simply present the truth in an evocative and really powerful ways that reach people, that touch people in their inner spiritual lives. And because the people who are hungry, we'll just ignore the other voices because they're looking for the food that they're hungry for. So, you know, and you just grow the right stuff and the other stuff will atrophy eventually is a part of it. You know,
mm-hmm.
Jesus never struggled with people trying to persuade them that God existed with the atheists.
Right.
He just assumed and went on and said, this is how you connect with God.
Yeah.
Well,
he didn't attempt to pick... What, Chuck?
Oh, I was just going to say, I think a lot of people grow through atheism. Like they
right.
almost need. I mean,
exactly.
It's true for me, and I've talked to a lot of people who've said the same thing, where they've sort of had an atheist period in their life, where they kind of checked that out, experimented with it, and it was kind
mm-hmm.
of wiped the slate clean in terms of superstition and whatever, you know, uncomfortable things they might be carrying forward from institutional religion. You know, as a way to kind of sever all that, wipe the slate clean, and then rediscover God in a way that's not bound to membership and in an organization or a tradition,
right.
a whole bunch of other traditional stuff that goes with it.
It's
a purely personal discovery of the reality of God, uncomplicated
mm-hmm.
by anything else. And,
yeah.
and in a way, atheism almost in a weird way, kind of can, for some people at least. Serve as a path to that place. Strange
maybe it
that
clears
means,
the deck, right? It clears the deck
clears
of all
the
superstition.
Yeah, because there's so many,
yeah.
people, so many people have so many resentments about religion.
Right.
So many just
well,
things
yeah.
that they really are not at all comfortable with remembering or thinking about. And, you know, throwing the baby out with the bathwater and all that. It's always a problem. But this kind of opportunity to rediscover God free of any other even human cultural associations, just as a actual reality, you know, like the rain and the wind and Niagara Falls, you know.
Yeah.
God is a reality.
Right.
Not a human invention or just a belief. It's a reality. So to get to that place is
reality.
Part of what we're dealing with. So I'm wondering about these whole cultures and nations and civilizations. They may be going through that. You know,
yeah,
in a way.
Good point.
There may be a surprising renaissance of spiritual discovery in some of these countries that, you know, have these bouts with enforced atheism. It may.
Yes.
You know, that, who knows? So that's the thing about this world. We never quite know. Sometimes when things look at their worst, that's the seed for the dawning of the next day, which all of a sudden it's like, whoa. It's like, oh, everything's changed. Everything's becoming new now, that idea.
Well, yeah, and it could be the slingshot effect or the bow effect, where the farther down we are held, then the farther forward we'll propel when things finally break loose. And you know, based on the conversation we just had, I want to share this paragraph, this cross reference from paper 10276. It's interesting how these religion papers are so relevant to this seraphic planetary you know, government. But this says the God-knowing individual is not one who is blind to the difficulties or unmindful of the obstacles which stand in the way of finding God in the maze of superstition, tradition, and materialistic tendencies of modern times. He has encountered all these deterrents and triumphed over them, surmounted them by living faith, and attained the highlands of spiritual experience in spite of them. But it is true that many who are inwardly sure about God fear to assert such feelings of certainty because of the multiplicity of cleverness of those who assemble objections and magnify difficulties about believing in God. It requires no great depth of intellect to pick flaws, ask questions, or raise objections, but it does require brilliance of mind to answer these questions and solve these difficulties. Faith certainty is the greatest technique for dealing with all such superficial contentions.
Yeah, so that's a lovely paragraph, Paula, and I think part of what I hear it saying to me is, and to us is, you know, we need to stand strong and represent and live the alternative to that secularistic, atheistic vision and say, you know, whether you're within a religious tradition or outside of it, if you are spiritually hungry, you can have this amazing gift of relationship with God directly in your life, and it can change and transform how you live and how you experience life. And, you know, come with us and let's together discover how to enter into this adventure, you know. And when you stand strong and you make those statements, you offer a cultural alternative to all of the people who are seeking. And I think eventually, what will come out of this revelation is a movement or movements that essentially do that effectively and act as a beacon to call those who are hungry, you know, to come and be fed. I mean, that's what they're saying. We must, and that eventually is what must come out of this revelatory movement that we're part of. You know, so, I mean, it's just, and we're in partnership with these wonderful angelic sisters in accomplishing that purpose.
Planetary government.
Yeah.
So maybe should we read that section, or go ahead, Chuck?
Yes, we should.
Just one question before we go there. this reference to the spiritual rebirth of the Jesus Brotherhood in that short paragraph in paper 195, that you know, they're saying that should thrill all who believe in him. That phrase, spiritual Jesus Brotherhood, is kind of defined in what they mean by that. And this is also actually paper 195, a little bit later in the same section, interestingly enough, where they say that the true church, the Jesus Brotherhood, is invisible.
Right.
Spiritual. And it's characterized by unity, not necessarily by uniformity. So I've always been intrigued by
Read the rest of it, Chuck, about the living organism.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, so the living Jesus is the only hope. Well, I'll just read the whole paragraph. Christianity is seriously confronted with the doom embodied in one of its own slogans. A house divided against itself cannot stand. The non-Christian world will hardly capitulate to a sect-divided Christendom. The living Jesus is the only hope of a possible unification of Christianity. The true church, the Jesus Brotherhood, is invisible, spiritual, and is characterized by unity, not necessarily by uniformity. Uniformity is the earmark of the physical world of mechanistic nature. Spiritual unity is the fruit of faith union with the living Jesus. The visible church should refuse longer to handicap the progress of the invisible and spiritual brotherhood of the kingdom of God. And this brotherhood is destined to become a living organism in italics, in contrast to an institutionalized social organization. It may well utilize such organizations, but it must not be supplanted by them. Yeah.
So this, there is this larger, there's this larger living reality that transcends every human institution, and it's a symbol, it's a symbolic vision of what we are all part of. And when we really embrace it, and it's the heart of Jesus' teaching, you know, we're all part of something much larger, and our relationship to each other must grow out of our relationship to the Father and to Jesus and to the, you know, being the branches. And when we really understand that and live that, then people have something they can be part of that transcends every other affiliation, that's unifying globally, you know, across the broad spectrum. And it's a big challenge to figure out how to live that and share it, but that's the challenge and the crisis of our age, I think, in a globalizing period of civilization. That's the challenge of our age, is to figure out how to grow and share that vision of what we're all part of, that Jesus was trying to share with us, you know?
And if we love it, we should live by his teachings, right?
Right, and that should be recognizable.
Yeah.
That should be recognizable somehow, regardless of what you say. You know,
it's
startling.
That's what it is. It has to be alive, but it has to be coherent enough to be, you know, shareable, you know? So that's the challenge, I think.
And demonstrable, demonstrated.
Yeah.
Well, I love where Jesus says, "You shall love one another with a new and startling affection."
Right.
Yes.
Right. And why is it startling? Because no one would expect it. It startles because no one expects it. You should hate that
inseparable
person. Why are you being kind to them? You know, that's startling.
And it's inseparable from a living process. I mean, that's what Jesus was saying, is unless you have a live connection with God and are open to it all the time, you know, it's their empty words. It has to be, like you say, it has to be alive. And that paragraph in the Supreme Papers where they say the love of, you know, comes into us from the indwelling Spirit, we share it with each other, and then it returns in service ministry to the Supreme. That's alive and thrilling. It's always moving. And so that's the heart of what he was teaching as well, is, you know, it's not simply words or a doctrine or a formula. It's a way of living. You know, you have to live
and
in
mode.
These relationships. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And love.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's transformative. So, you know, I mean, that's what we have to work with. We need to be working with this stuff.
Yeah,
creating an invisible brotherhood, you know, thinking about, okay, how, if I met you on the street, how would I know if you're in the invisible brotherhood or not, right? And to try to figure out, okay, how can I project that I am in that invisible brotherhood? How am I going to act? How am I going to behave? How am I going to live my life so that others can see that I'm part of this invisible brotherhood? You know, what does that mean in terms of the way our lives play out, the way we treat people, all of that? You know, that has to be part of it somehow.
Our local friend Archie Anderson made some bumper stickers once, and one of the most popular ones, and Andrea will remember, we used to sell these bumper stickers when we would do our outreach at the People's Fair. And by far, there were two of these stickers that he made, phrases coined from your Rancho book teachings, that people loved the most. One was, "Humor is the oil in life's engine." We sold a ton of those. And the other one was, "The real church is invisible."
Mm-hmm.
People really get that, you know.
Concept. They dug that, huh? Wow.
Yeah. And we would sell out on those ones every time, you know. I mean, they by far loved those two the most. "Humor is the oil in life's engine," and "The real church is invisible." Those are good ones.
Yeah, those are both great. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So true.
So shall we read section 5? We probably won't get to talk about it much, but who wants to read that? Andre, do you want to?
Yeah, Andre's been quiet. Andre, you want to read?
Andre may be getting a cup of coffee. or talking to somebody.
You want me to take
Go
a
ahead.
Call?
Go ahead, Marvin.
Yeah. And Andre, if you come back in, interrupt, please, and you can take over.
Sorry, I was just having trouble unmuting.
Oh, you were having trouble unmuting. Do you want to read this section?
Sure, why not?
Okay, great.
It's a good one. And I know I can get through it quickly.
Okay.
The planetary government. The actual administration of Urantia is indeed difficult to describe. There exists no formal government along the lines of universe organization, such as separate legislative, executive, and judicial departments. The 24 counselors come the nearest to being the legislative branch of the planetary government. The governor general is a provisional and advisory chief with the veto power resident in the most high observer. And there are no absolutely authoritative judicial powers operative on the planet, only the conciliating commissions. A majority of the problems involving Seraphim and Midwares are by mutual consent decided by the Governor General. But except when voicing the mandates of the 24 councils, his rulings are all subject to appeal to conciliating commissions, to local authorities constituted for planetary function, or even to the system sovereign of Satania. The absence of the corporeal staff of a planetary prince and the material regime of an Adamic son and daughter is partially compensated by the special ministry of Seraphim and by the unusual services of the midway creatures. The absence of the planetary prince is effectively compensated by the triune presence of the archangels, the most high observer, and the governor general. The rather loosely organized and somewhat personally administered planetary government is more than expectedly effective because of the time-saving assistance of the archangels in their ever-ready circuit, which is so frequently utilized in planetary emergencies and administrative difficulties. Technically, the planet is still spiritually isolated in the Norlaishadex circuits. But in an emergency, this handicap can now be circumvented through utilization of the archangel circuit. Planetary isolation is, of course, of little concern to individual mortals, since the pouring out of the Spirit of Truth upon all flesh 1900 years ago. Each administrative day on Urantia begins with a consultative conference, which is attended by the Governor General, the Planetary Chief of Archangels, the Most High Observer, the Supervising Superniphim, Chief of Resident Life Carriers, and invited guests from among the High Sons of the Universe or from among certain of the student visitors who may chance to be sojourning on the planet. The Direct Administrative Cabinet of the Governor General consists of 12 Seraphim, the acting chiefs of the 12 groups of special angels functioning as the immediate superhuman directors of planetary progress and stability.
Well,
so,
we have lots of questions. I have questions too.
Go ahead.
I just want everybody to talk all at once. That's what I want. More than anything.
Well, that's sort of a metaphor for what's going on in our seraphic planetary government. You know, it's like,
in a way.
What struck me was, and I never got this takeaway before, and so it's really, there's always new stuff that comes out of these readings.
I know.
What struck me this time was, in a normal situation, because they begin this section with saying, the actual administration of Urantia is indeed difficult to describe. There exists no formal government along the lines of universe organization. So the implication is we are in a very unusual state in terms of how affairs are managed on this world. And the The next thing that struck me was in the third paragraph where they say, the absence of the corporeal staff of a planetary prince and the material regime of an Adamic son and daughter is partially compensated by a whole series of things that they then describe. So the normal order on a normal world is you have these long-established headquarters of administration, the planetary prince, the Adamic son and daughter, and they're in touch with all of the invisible beings related to the planet, and they're running things in a customary order that is probably pretty well established and not too dissimilar across normal evolutionary planets, and none of that is in place here. So the word that keeps coming to mind in what they've described here is, in with the best intentions, it's jury-rigged. You know, it's a temporary adaptation.
They say that too.
Of many different personalities and agencies, and they're all sort of adapting to this very unusual situation. And they've sort of evolved a way of doing things, but it's highly unusual and not at all like what's going on a normal world. And that's a really interesting takeaway from, you know, when they say in the second last paragraph, each administrative day, this is who runs the place here. Each administrative day on your rancho begins with a consultative conference attended by these beings who normally would not be running things on an evolutionary world. Normally it would be the planetary prince and Adam and Eve, maybe with these other assistants. But you've got the governor general, the planetary chief of archangels, which is unusual, the most high observer, which is unusual, and the supervising supernifim, and the chief of the resident life carriers, and then an assortment of invited guests from other high suns of the universe as needed. So it's like everyone's pitching in this vacuum of administrative leadership for this world, and it's kind of working, but it's a major adaptation, which is really intriguing. Mm-hmm. You know,
it's missing from that list in that paragraph, though, are the acting chiefs of the supervising, you know, the seraphic, definitely the seraphic groups, acting chiefs of the 12 groups and special angels. That they're not. I would have expected that those 12 chiefs.
But they're the cabinet of the governor general.
They're
his cabinet.
The governor general.
Right.
So maybe they're.
So he represents them. I would
not mention. Yeah.
Yeah.
But still. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah. You would think. I agree. And I noticed that too, Chuck. And then it says that the last paragraph.
Yeah.
That it says the direct administrative cabinet of the governor general consists of the 12 seraphim, and here's somebody else that's not listed there, which is all important. And if you think about the Adam and Eve and the material aspect of planetary government, the material aspect, the on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground aspect is the humans. Mm-hmm. But isn't it interesting that we will cover them in this paper under the Reserve Corps, the Planetary Reserve Corps of Destiny. And
well,
they are, yes, they are covered. And they are all important because we... humans are the boots on the ground. And
right.
if there were an Adam and Eve and a planetary headquarters here and a material aspect, a material civilization, culture, all evolving around the fact of the planetary Adam and Eve, then it wouldn't be such a challenge. But as it is, you know, it becomes all important that we can embrace the reality of our planetary supervisors and believe that we can work with them. And even know, as this beautiful revelation has told us, how that might happen, what they are doing, and how we might serve with them in this all-important work.
Well,
making
and
that
would there
bridge
also,
to the material level.
Would there also be, I'm trying this, I know one of you will probably know this, how long the members of the mortal associates of the planetary prince, the 100, how long do they leave at the inauguration of the Adamic regime, or are they still around as well? The members of the corporeal staff.
No,
because
they
were
gone.
I know,
They were taken. The ones that didn't go into rebellion got taken off.
I'm talking.
But in a normal world, how long would they stay?
Oh, just till the Adamic regime.
Okay.
But you still would have.
Yeah, they don't keep them here forever.
And then the planetary prince, though, is still there, right? And
what they indicated about it, you know, is that what they had hoped would happen at the end of the planetary prince regime, you know, had this functioned normally, would have been for the prince's staff, the corporeal staff, to have procreated. And they projected that they didn't know what kind of interesting, you know, beings would come from that. They would be human beings, but they anticipated that it might be a race of super teachers that would have come from that as a result of their having still been connected to the Tree of Life and not having disrupted their connection to the Satania life currents. But since they procreated afterwards.
Were they supposed to mate with the... Yeah.
No, they were supposed to mate with each other.
Well, that's what
and
I was
the, and
trying to get at when you say...
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might have done that. They wouldn't have because they were going to be taken off. No, they were going to... Their offspring might at some point,
mm-hmm.
yes, but not
yeah,
them themselves.
Yeah, I thought that was kind of the... Mm.
No, I mean,
because
they're
just
gone.
To speak,
you know, Adam and Eve come and they're gone.
And they get to leave. So
They don't leave till the ages of life and light. Adam and Eve stick around for a long time.
I'm not talking about Adam
and
Eve.
So,
I'm talking about the corporeal staff.
The corporeal other material representation.
So just speaking to your point, Paula, there would have, on a normal world, there would be two populations of human beings that were very high quality human beings. There would be the million progeny of Adam and Eve, or however many, half a million.
And more.
Plus all of their descendants, And there would have been the progeny on a normal world of the planetary prince staff. There would have been two centers of civilization and two groups of human beings, as you mentioned, Andre, like super teachers, that would have been really stabilizing culture and civilization for hundreds of thousands of years. And also to have association with the superhuman government of the world who could see these higher beings. And we have none of that, you know.
Right.
We have such a poverty of these structures on this world.
But excuse me if I'm wrong, but I don't think the corporeal staff normally leave offspring, do they, Andre? I thought that was a feature of our planet because Caligastia had them do that.
Well, I found the paragraph where they talk about that. At least
did you?
On our planet, yeah. And this is in paper 77-22, what Andre was bringing up. They say the physical members of the prince's staff have been constituted sex creatures for the purpose of participating in the plan of procreating offspring, embodying the combined qualities of their special order united with those of the selected stock of the Andon tribes. And all of this was in anticipation of the subsequent appearance of Adam. The life carriers had planned a new type of mortal embracing the union of the conjoined offspring of the prince's staff with the first generation offspring of Adam and Eve. They had thus projected a plan envisioning a new order of planetary creatures whom they hoped would become the teacher rulers of human society. Such beings are designed for social sovereignty, not civil sovereignty. But since this plan almost completely miscarried, we'll never know. But that was the idea they had.
Read the rest of the paragraph. It says, but since this project almost all go ahead, Chuck. Read the rest of it.
Yeah, but since this project almost completely miscarried, we shall never know what an aristocracy of benign leadership and matchless culture. Your answer was thus deprived of. For when the corporeal staff later reproduced, it was subsequent to the rebellion and after they had been deprived of their connection with the life currents of the system.
So, you know, the implication here is, and I'd never caught this connection, is there's this intriguing mention, the first sentence, the physical members of the prince's staff had been constituted as sex creatures for the purpose of participating in the plan of procreating offspring, embodying the combined qualities of their special order, united with those of the selected stock of the Andon tribes. So that's very interesting because this seems to be a feature of the decimal world status.
Mm-hmm.
Here. The life guards were trying to do something that was new and different, and it could be an association. It sounds suspiciously like it was an association with the early advent of human will in the Andonic tribes, which was also part of their decimal experiment. They do say that, is that normally human will doesn't appear in Andon and Fanta and their ancestor. It appears with the advent of the colored races, which comes a little later. But here it appeared early, and they seem to have had plans of mating between the corporeal staff and the Andonic tribes. So that's really that's really interesting.
Yeah, look down at paragraph 4. You want to read that too? Is that even with the loss of the system life currents, they describe what happened.
Yeah, it says since the 100 corporeal, this is 77-2-4, so it's 2-2 and 2-4. Since the 100 corporeal members of the prince's staff carry germplasm of the Andonic human strains, that's right, that's Van and Amadon, you know, Amadon was characteristic. It would naturally be expected that if they engaged in sexual reproduction, their progeny would altogether resemble the offspring of other Andonite parents. But when the 60 rebels of the staff, the followers of Nod, actually engaged in sexual reproduction, their children proved to be far superior in almost every way to both the Andonite and the Sangic peoples. This unexpected excellence characterized not only physical and intellectual qualities, but also spiritual capacities.
That would have been the Nodites.
That would have been the Nodites. It's been a while since I read that, and that's amazing to think about. Yeah. Just imagine. And so here we are to recap. Not only are we the boots on the ground, we're all they've got. We're not as good as we might have been.
The implication, the additional implication, though, Paul, is that we do have representatives genetically of the prince's staff revelation, because when they say, thus the Denodite peoples, this is paragraph 6, arise out of certain peculiar and unexpected modifications occurring in the life plasm, which had been transferred from the bodies of the Andonite contributors to those of the corporeal staff members by the Avalon surgeons. So, and then the Denodites married with the Adamites and produced the Andites, which they say had a major influence on our civilizations genetically. So there is some carry down of some of that influence.
Yeah, of course. Yeah. To one degree or another. But still, our work is cut out for us, and we're talking about how challenging we have been today. It might be to work with our planetary government. You know, it seems obvious what we need to do, you know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, there is this issue that we have. How do we create a bridge from the human to the superhuman level that's as effective and direct as possible? And normally that would be provided, is why all these, you know, developments we've been reading about. But in our case, those have all been kind of broken and, you know, dismantled or whatever. So we're faced with this problem of how do we create a bridge? from our
well, here's the thought.
To the superhuman level.
Our knowledge, the knowledge that we're given here in this revelation, and just for an example, tells us about these conciliators. And what they do is they go through the universe, and it mentions them in that section Andre just read, that they're kind of the judicial aspect. And I find it deeply fascinating what they do and their ability to act and to solve conflicts. And we know this. And we could actually call them in more often if we wanted to.
Conciliating.
Even though, yeah, we have huge conflicts on this planet, huge conflicts. And let's just take between the Israelis and the Palestinians as one example. We could ask conciliators, and maybe our planetary supervisors already have, you know, maybe they already have, but we could. We could ask for conciliators to come and resolve some of the huge conflicts we have on this planet. And, you know, that's one thing we could do. And I watched a documentary last night, which was fascinating. It was Close Encounters of the Fifth Kind. And the whole documentary is about it's about the experiences of Dr. Stephen Greer. And, and how he pulls these groups of people together. And through meditation, and I get the feeling that he is a transcendental meditation, a practitioner of transcendental meditation, they meditate and they call in what they believe are, aliens. But the documentary is fascinating because the things they're describing, the realities they're describing in this documentary, you'll recognize from the Urantia book. And the fact that, you know, we're in one mind and, you know, quantum physics and all of this is all stuff that's covered, you know, so thoroughly in the Urantia book. But they'll get together, he'll get these groups together and they'll meditate and actually call in these beings. They think they're aliens. I think they're probably midwayers that they're calling in. And they appear to them. So there's something else we might think about doing is actually with intention getting together to pray for, you know, for them to guide us.
Have to say it beggars belief a little bit. I certainly appreciate that they could do that, but it really flies in the face of so many other things regarding, you know, isolation. I do think we can get help. You know, Paul, I think your idea is a wonderful idea.
Well, aliens is what I'm saying. I think they're calling in is
angelic,
right here on this planet
angelic.
With us.
Yeah.
But anyway, go ahead, Andre.
What I'm saying is, who's going to – what really is required is for a will to surrender sovereignty of the problem in order to – for it to be overcome that way. If that sovereignty can be surrendered, then there would be a basis for solving it humanly. And we don't have that will to surrender. What we need is we need people to get to the point of being willing to surrender to what could be accomplished by group wisdom together.
Yes,
Let's throw in some other things to the picture here. And, you know, it's an intriguing question I think I'm hearing from you, Paula, which is it's still the question, how do we get from here to there, you know, there?
That bridge that Chuck was talking about.
Yeah, yeah, the beginnings of the ages of light and life, when we as human beings and human civilization do have a connection with the seraphic government, and we are in touch with what's going on in the universe, and we're getting even, you know, as they say in Ages of Light and Life, universe broadcasts, we're in communication as normal planets are. How do we get from here to eventually there is the question.
Mm-hmm.
And they give us some intriguing hints. They say at some future time, You know, they speculate that it's entirely possible that Jesus may be back here in some fashion capacity, and Melchizedek and Adam and Eve.
And Adam and Eve
and a planetary prince and any combination. So at some point, our world culture will evolve to the point, I think, where the points of view that we have from this revelation, if they're not universally accepted, they're enough accepted by a sizable minority of the population that world culture is, in a sense, ready for, you know, what I think will come consistent with the, or at the same time as the adjudication of the Lucifer Rebellion and the restoration of the circuits in the universe. We're not going to be able to figure this out. They will have to figure out how to provide a sequence of steps that gets us back to something like the ages of light and life with these planetary centers of administration
right.
and connection
right.
with the seraphic government. That's got to be in their thinking and planning at some level higher up.
I agree.
And we need to be ready to cooperate, kind of like when Adam and Eve came down. You know, we need to be ready to cooperate with whatever they may attempt to do. But I think that's well out ahead in the future. But I think
I'm so glad you're talking about this, Marvin. You know why?
Why?
You know why? Because just a couple of sections down from here, they tell us what they're thinking of in terms of getting closer toward that. That's really the bridge. And the bridge, they tell us what the requirements are. You know, one of the biggest issues with building that bridge is summed up in one word, selfishness. We as a species, as individuals, are humanly selfish. To work with that kind of a government on the level of the universe requires true altruism, a true sense of brotherhood and sisterhood, a true sense of our connection to God, and a true desire to serve unselfishly. And that's a long way off for 99.999% of people. But there is a very small procession amount, you know, approximately 1,000 in 7 billion, give or take, we don't know how many today, that do qualify, that are dedicated to some avenue and are unselfish and do not seek personal recognition for it. That's what's required.
Yeah, I agree, Andre. And you know what? That's a good place to leave it for today, because next week we have the Master's Seraphim of Planetary Supervision, and that is a long section. It describes all 12 of those cores, those master cores of Seraphim, and then, of course, after that, the Reserve Core of Destiny, which always fills everybody with wonder. And you know, let's contemplate building that bridge. What it might take to do that.
You and Cafe participants last night studied that and discussed
it.
It's
amazing how, you know, it seems to me sometimes Spirit is directing our movement. Do you get that feeling? We're being directed, and many of us are all talking about the same things at the same time. I've always noticed that.
Well, they described that bridge in paper 38, that we can save that for next time.
Okay. Yeah, let's contemplate the bridge.
That's
over
good.
The next
You've
week
given us
or
some slurping to do, Chuck. That's right.
Some sleuthing. There you go.
Well, and the connection of some of these core of angels, like the angels of the future, the angels of the religious angels, the ethical angels, the progress angels, all these core that I'm sure are very engaged in various ways with what we're attempting to do with this revelation. So that'll be a fun section next week.
These last two sections are amazing. So, well, thank you, friends, for listening. We loved seeing you on the board today, Trudy and Perry and Diane and Gary and Robert. Oh, gosh, it's always so great to see you guys.
And we had our villa and Vaughn in the background as well.
Yes.
Wonderful.
And so great to see you guys on the call. And we will be back next week to discuss that bridge that Chuck laid out, that he threw down the gauntlet, and the Master Seraphim. So that'll be a fun one. And
right.
Thank you. Till next time,
yeah,
you guys.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us. That's great to hear.
Yeah.
You bet.
Yeah. Love you.
See you
all
next
so
week.
Much.
Yeah.
Good to be back.
Love you guys.
Love you too.
Take care.
Bye for now.
Till next time. Bye.
Okay.
For now.
More later. Bye.
Bye.
You've been listening to The Cosmic Citizen, a radio program focused primarily on the study and discussion of the Urantia Book and its teachings. The Urantia Book is a religious text that claims to be written by angels and other superhuman personalities. If you are a Urantia Book reader or a spiritual seeker looking for new truth, we hope and pray you have been nourished and edified by our ministry. Please remember that the views expressed on this program do not reflect the official views and opinions of any Urantia organizations. There is no official interpretation of the Urantia Book. So all opinions expressed on this program exclusively reflect the personal biases of the hosts, guests, and callers who participate in these discussions. And remember, only a brave person is willing honestly to admit and fearlessly to face what a sincere and logical mind discovers.